Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 256, Side A. And what you're about to hear is excerpted from the One Step Beyond program of Thursday, October 26th of the year 2000. We're going to begin by taking a look at some aspects of Campaign 2000, which have really not received the significance due them. They're just not getting the proper attention. A lot of people have been paying attention to what the candidates have been saying, but anyone familiar with the Bush family is familiar with the fact that they play hardball. A friend of mine that departed a number of years ago used to refer to George Bush, that's George Bush Sr., the elder, as Killer Bush. Of course, he was former director of the CIA. There's available evidence, as we saw in number 244, for the record 244, as well as RFA 37, that George Bush may very well have been working for the intelligence community from the time he graduated from Yale, when he went to work for Dresser Industries, right on up through the present time. Officially, he was only director of Central Intelligence and with the agency for 1 year. Yet the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, is named for George Bush. Whenever a member of the Bush family is entering the political lists, one should look for the telltale signs of covert action. Although I have reservations about the Democratic candidate, Al Gore, fact of the matter is, I find the discussion, and one finds this in the mainstream press and the alternative press, that there is no significant difference between Al Gore and George Bush. That is not only wrong, it's politically illiterate and historically illiterate. The differences are enormous. And sadly, if people do not recognize those differences, they're going to pay very dearly with their lives and the lives of their loved ones, not through any conflagration or war, although that's a possibility, but simply because they're going to get sick from the poisons in the environment, and they're not going to have any medical care, and their kids are going to be idiots, and an awful lot of the people around them are going to be idiots because they're not going to get any education, and then they won't be able to make any intelligent decisions about what's going on. But what we're going to look at is Campaign 2000, seen from the standpoint of probable covert action. First article comes from the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, September 14th of the year 2000. This particular occurrence during Campaign 2000 is reminiscent of when a George Bush was running on the Republican ticket 20 years ago. That was when George Bush was running for vice president, and there appears to have been some shenanigans with regard to debate preparation materials. Again, the Mercury of 9/14/2000 has a New York Times story by Catherine Q. Seeley, S-E-E-L-Y-E, Dateline Washington, headlined, Bush documents appear in mailbox of Gore campaign. And skipping down, we read about this. The Gore campaign was eager to get the story out in a hurry for fear that Gore might suffer if people believed he had gained an improper advantage. Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign was criticized in 1980 after it obtained secret papers on the debate strategy of then-president Jimmy Carter. This reference here, let me reread that last sentence. Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign was criticized in 1980 after it obtained secret papers on the debate strategy of then-president Jimmy Carter. One of the things that did not get a lot of discussion in Debategate was that in addition to having secret material or having materials that had apparently been secreted away from the Carter camp, bear in mind that Donald Gregg, later George Bush's national security advisor, was on Jimmy Carter's National Security Council and in all probability a mole. But one of the things that the Republicans had, they had secret documents that had been taken from the United States Embassy in Tehran by the Islamic militants who seized the U.S. hostages there. That being a concrete indicator of collusion between the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980 and the Khomeini forces in Iran. In the second half of Campaign 2000, probably something we will be getting to on Sunday, we're going to take a look at a possible role of Islamic militants and the Iranians in particular in the current array in the Middle East, something that threatens to affect the campaign very directly. Now, as I said, when a member of the Bush family is running for public office, one wants to keep one's eyes peeled for dirty tricks and covert operations, and the propensity of the Bush political heritage for dirty tricks and covert operations, not to mention killing people, is one of the fundamental differences between Al Gore and the Bushes. Indeed, I think it is not only necessary to view George W. Bush as the heir to a political heritage, because he has almost no record on his own. He's been a lousy governor, although the governor of Texas has very little power. The fact of the matter is, all of his advisors were his father's advisors, and it's pretty upfront that a George W. Bush administration will be a second George H.W. Bush administration. San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, October 16th of the year 2000, had an article which puts the latest shenanigans vis-a-vis debate, the debate situation, and the apparent theft of debate materials in perspective. Some of the best commentary that's been issued on Campaign 2000 has come from Molly Ivins, a syndicated columnist out of Texas. And this particular column, carried by the Chronicle on Monday, October 16th of the year 2000 and datelined Austin, Texas, was headlined, "Neither Bush nor Gore are candidates for Mount Rushmore." But about the McKinnon Gate, the alleged theft of the debate materials, Molly Ivins has the following to say, and as she notes quite properly, the rest of the press seems to have missed this one. On L'Affaire McKinnon-Gate, as we now call the flap over who pinched Bush's debate material and sent it to a Gore campaign honcho, the media seemed to be operating in a curious historical vacuum. I would add that I think that is generally true, and not just in this specific instance. Continuing, the Texas press has managed to recall that we have seen similar events before, but that national media remain clueless. In 1984, Karl Rove, R-O-V-E, the campaign manager now known as Bush's brain, was working for Bill Clements in the gubernatorial election against Mark White. A bug was allegedly found in Rove's office by a private security firm a few days before the televised debate between White and Clements. The case made headlines around the state. The FBI was called in to investigate. More headlines. The implication was clear. Dirty work at the crossroads by the White campaign. White lost. The culprit was never found. Again in 1990, when Rove was working for Rick Perry, who was then running against Democratic Agricultural Commissioner Jim Hightower, Rove leaked news of another FBI investigation, this time against Hightower for alleged misuse of funds. Hightower was never charged with anything, although three of his aides were later convicted. Texas Democrats became quite paranoid about the pattern of the FBI being called in to investigate Democrats just before an election. Rove was questioned about the pattern during a Senate confirmation hearing to a Board of Regents position, and, as I reported in a column, there are discrepancies between his answers to the Texas Senate and his answers on a U.S. Senate questionnaire later obtained by subpoena. McKinnon-Gate has a similar feel. Well, kudos to Molly Ivins for reporting what most of the rest of the media have not reported. One of the most disturbing things, and I was wondering how long it was going to be before people started dying in this campaign, one of the most disturbing things is the way in which a recent plane crash has altered the political landscape in this country, or at least the landscape of the electoral race. I want to stress that I'm not in a position to state without qualification that there is foul play behind this particular airplane crash. But nonetheless, I think in a country where political assassination has become an established tradition over a period of decades, I think that the question is an important one to ask, and for veteran Bush watchers, so to speak, the type of incident that I'm about to relate has a very, very disturbing feel. In particular, as I go through the next several articles, I want people to note the juxtaposition from a temporal and journalistic slash editorial standpoint of a number of key items, which I think place some of what I'm about to relate in a very interesting perspective. The New York Times, on Monday, October 16th, that was the Monday before this past Monday, had an article on the front page by David E. Rosenbaum. It's datelined Washington, October 15th. It's headlined, "Democrats Have Outside Chance to Wrest Senate." Subtitled, "Either Way, a Close Split. Eight incumbents, including seven in GOP, are in trouble. Lieberman race at issue." And skipping down, the Republican senators who are in trouble are William V. Roth, Jr. of Delaware, Spencer Abraham of Michigan, Rod Grams of Minnesota, and then it got named several, including John Ashcroft of Missouri. Missouri is a key state, as we're going to see, for a variety of reasons. John Ashcroft is running for re-election against, he was running for re-election. When that article was written on Monday, October 16th of this year, he was running for re-election against the governor of Missouri, a very popular governor, Mel Carnahan. That is no longer the case. The day after the article that I just read, just excerpted for you, appeared on the front page of the New York Times, newspapers, including the San Francisco Examiner of Tuesday, October 17th of the year 2000, carried accounts similar to what I'm about to relate. This is an AP story by Jim Salter, S-A-L-T-E-R. It's datelined Goldman, Missouri. It's headlined, "Governor and Two Others Flying in Bad Weather." And it reads in part as follows. Governor Mel Carnahan, the Democratic candidate in one of the most hotly contested U.S. Senate races in the country, was killed when the plane shuttling him to a campaign rally crashed in rainy, foggy weather. Note that, because there appear to be some discrepancies about just what the weather was like. skipping down, they had been traveling to a rally for Carnahan, 66, who was engaged in a heated battle with Republican John Ashcroft. That was one of the races that you heard alluded to in that New York Times story. And skipping down still further, quote, "We found wreckage in very small pieces spread over a large area. We have found some remains we cannot identify at this point," unquote, said Captain Ed Kemp of the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department. Note that they found wreckage in very small pieces spread over a very large area. That is not conclusive in and of itself, but one wonders whether that is perhaps symptomatic of a mid-air explosion. If it was a small plane and simply crashed, that seems like an unlikely pattern for the wreckage. Skipping down again, State Senator Jerry Howard, who was at the rally, said Roy Temple, executive director of the Missouri Democratic Party, got a page at about 8 p.m. from Chris Sifford. Sifford, S-I-F-F-O-R-D, told Temple that the governor's plane had encountered lightning and was going to return to St. Louis or Jefferson City, Howard said. Skipping down, note the time, the timing of the death of Governor Carnahan. Carnahan's name will stay on the November 7th ballot because the deadline for changing it was Friday, Secretary of State Becky Cook said. So Governor Carnahan's name will necessarily remain on the ballot because the deadline was Friday, no pun intended, and Governor Carnahan, again, challenging John Ashcroft and seen as possibly helping to wrest control of the Senate for the Democrats, Governor Carnahan is no longer among the ranks of the living. By the way, bear in mind that control of the Senate is going to prove crucial for federal judicial nominees. The Senate approves presidential appointments. And in addition to Supreme Court nominees, bear in mind that the president appoints the federal judges at the appellate level, and they also serve for life, are an almost impossible entity to remove. The New York Times of Monday, October 16th, carried the article saying the Democrats had a thin chance of wresting control of the Senate. The New York Times of Wednesday, October 18th of the year 2000, had a very different analysis as a result of this plane crash. This is an article by James Dow, DAO, at Dateline St. Louis, October 17th, and headlined "Equation Changed by a Fatal Crash," subtitled "The Loss of a Candidate Hurts Democrats' Senate Chances." And this article reads in part as follows. The death of Governor Mel Carnahan of Missouri in a plane crash Monday night has thrown the already tumultuous politics of this important swing state into disarray and probably diminished the Democrats' chances of recapturing the Senate this year, Democrats and political analysts said today. Skipping down, Mr. Carnahan's death could have reverberations beyond his own race and even beyond his own state, political analysts said. Missouri has achieved an unusual trifecta in national politics this year, a fiercely contested Senate race, a too-close-to-call contest for governor, and a heated battle for its 11 electoral votes, which are considered up for grabs between the two major presidential candidates. And skipping down again, but beyond that, analysts said, the loss of Missouri's most powerful and popular Democrat could also dampen Democratic turnout at the polls, hurting Mr. Gore and the party's gubernatorial candidate, State Treasurer Bob Holden. Quote, without Carnahan, the Senate race now becomes an asterisk, unquote, said Stuart Rothenberg, editor of the Rothenberg Political Report, a nonpartisan newsletter. Again, quoting, you have to wonder whether that affects the Democrats' mood. There's a potential that it will hurt Gore, unquote. And the L.A. Times of Wednesday, October 18th of the year 2000, had an article by Stephanie Simon of the L.A. Times headlined, Governor Mourned as Public Servant, subtitled Democrats' Death Likely to Have National Impact in Lost Senate Seat. And skipping down of the death of Governor Carnahan, we read, Democrats also could come up with an alternative candidate before the election, but he or she would have to run as a write-in. Party officials dismissed that plan as impractical and all but resigned themselves to an Ashcroft victory. And of the circumstances surrounding the plane crash, we read the following. This from the New York Times of Wednesday, October 18th of the year 2000. Adjacent to the article I excerpted a moment ago is this article by John W. Fountain, Dateline St. Louis, October 17th, and headline, Doomed Plane Apparently Had Instrument Trouble. And skipping down, we read, pilots rely on several gyroscopes and gyrocompasses to read a plane's heading and orientation, and it was unclear which gyro was being referred to, the official said. They had gyro trouble. Well, first it said they had encountered lightning and said they were going back, and now apparently they had gyro trouble, or at least that's what we're being told. Continuing, the instruments become even more important in rain and clouds, the conditions on Monday night. Under those conditions, pilots can become disoriented and think a gyroscope's warning of danger is inaccurate. It could take months for the cause of the crash to become clearer, though. But Robert Bartlett, manager of St. Louis Downtown Parks Airport in Cahokia, Illinois, where the plane took off at 7 p.m., said, quote, "There was no unusually unsafe weather or even unusual weather," unquote, for flying on Monday night. In fact, Mr. Bartlett said that several planes arrived and departed within 10 minutes of the governor's plane taking off. "They had no problems," unquote, Mr. Bartlett said, referring to other planes, again quoting, "We had arrivals and departures until we closed at 9 p.m. The National Weather Service in St. Louis said the visibility at the time of the crash was 3 miles and that the area was having, quote, moderate to heavy rain, unquote, although apparently there was no lightning. Well, the earlier article said they turned back because of no lightning, because there was lightning, and we're told that it was terrible weather, and yet apparently it would not appear, at least from that account, that the weather was all that bad. I want to stress, obviously, there's not enough information to make any sort of definitive statement about foul play being involved in the death of Governor Carnahan. Nonetheless, anyone familiar with the history of the Bush family, and anyone familiar with the way they play hardball, would certainly have to ask some very uncomfortable questions and pointed questions about the death of Governor Carnahan. I had been wondering how long it was going to be before people started dropping dead in this particular race, and, well, we may very well have that answer. And certainly, the timing of the death of Governor Carnahan is very interesting indeed. Recall that there was discussion in the wake of the death of JFK Jr. that he was going to be nominated as the Democratic vice presidential candidate. And once again, we were told that the visibility was poor, and yet he was within visual contact of Martha's Vineyard Airport, had been cleared for landing, and was only 100 feet off the surface of the water. And although we were told for days that they had no idea where Kennedy's plane was, then they produced a radar track showing the plane dropping like a stone out of the sky. Well, if they were tracking it with radar, how come for days we were told they had no idea what had happened or where? That obviously is dramatically inconsistent. More on the subject of covert operation or perhaps propaganda or psychological warfare operations in connection with the election. The Los Angeles Times of Tuesday, October 17th of 2000, had the following article on the front page. It's by Mark Z. Barabak, and I may be mispronouncing that name, B-A-R-A-B-A-K. It's Dateline New Orleans headline, "For many blacks, election isn't on radar." Subtitled, "Campaign. Both parties court a less than enthusiastic constituency, long loyal to Democrats in toss-up states." And what this article is talking about is the fact that crucial to a Democratic victory will be a strong turnout on the part of African-American voters, and yet African-American voters, at least according to this article, are manifestly unenthused about the prospects for this race. The article reads in part as follows. Thelma French has a nightmare which goes like this. All across Louisiana, indeed all across America, millions of black voters stay home on Election Day, lulled by good times and convinced they have little stake in the presidential election. It is French's nightmare, but it should make Al Gore toss and turn. If the race stays close, black turnout could be crucial in deciding whether Gore or George W. Bush is elected on November 7th. On the inside of the paper, the continuation of that article on page A4 of the L.A. Times of Tuesday, October 17th of 2000, there is an article right above the continuation of the story I just excerpted, and this is about a rally that took place in Washington, D.C. This rally was effected by the organization of Louis Farrakhan, an individual about whom there are many questions in connection with the death of Malcolm X, the man whose mantle he assumed. And Farrakhan, of course, has achieved quite a bit of notoriety for some blatant anti-Semitic positions and statements. There have been accounts that he is turning over a new leaf. I would take those with a grain of salt. Witness the following. Now, bear in mind that this is, as analysts are saying, that a strong African-American turnout on Election Day appears to be essential for a potential Democratic victory. Farrakhan is rallying African-Americans in Washington, D.C., and is delivering a rather discouraging message about the campaign. Again, L.A. Times of 10-17-2000. This is an article by Marlene Simmons, C-I-M-O-N-S, of the L.A. Times, Dateline Washington, headlined, "Marchers Step Forward for Family Unity." Subtitled, "The Million Family March Delivers a Powerful Message to Its Black Participants, Especially the Children." And speaking of the election, this is what Farrakhan had to say, bearing in mind that a strong African-American turnout would appear to be essential for successful Democratic fortunes in November. There had been speculation before the march that Farrakhan planned to endorse one of the presidential candidates. Instead, he chided them both. Quote, It's almost like a choice between Beelzebub and the devil. You lose with either one, he said. Obviously, that is not the sort of statement that's going to encourage African-American voters to turn out in November. I think that's more than a little ironic on several accounts. It's significant and ironic in a number of ways. In the first place, it is very interesting to see Farrakhan making remarks which would discourage African-American turnout in November, exactly what the Republicans want. Also, I think it's very ironic to see Farrakhan referring to Gore and Bush as Beelzebub and the devil. Consider who was co-sponsoring this march with Louis Farrakhan, an individual whom I personally would classify as a black fascist. Continuing. In that spirit, Graves, this is one of the attendants at the march, in that spirit, Graves and his wife said they would renew their wedding vows, their 21st anniversary is next Monday, during the march's, quote, sacred marriage blessing, unquote, reminiscent of the mass weddings conducted by the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, whose Unification Church was a major sponsor of the march. So we have Moon and Farrakhan basically affecting this march in Washington, D.C. I would think that before Farrakhan labels Gore and Bush as Beelzebub and the devil, he ought to seriously consider what the juxtaposition of himself and Sun Myung Moon would appear to constitute. There are a number of things I find very interesting about that. In a number of broadcasts, including RFA number 7, I analyzed the Unification Church as the reconstitution and projection around the world of the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies that helped to bring fascism to Japan. Although nominally Korean, Korea was a Japanese colony until the end of World War II, and many of the early functionaries in the Unification Church were officers in the Imperial Japanese Army during the Second World War, and many of its early supporters, such as Yoshio Kodama and Roichi Sasakawa, were Japanese fascists who had been interned at Sagamo Prison at the end of the war and then released to serve in an anti-communist capacity. Kodama himself had been heavily associated with the patriotic and ultranationalist societies in the pre-World War II period. Now, on top of that, it's worth noting that the Moon Organization has very strong associations with the Bush camp. And indeed, after his formal retirement from the presidency in 1992, George H.W. Bush has been earning millions of dollars in very lucrative honoraria that have been made available to him for his speaking engagements or as a result of his speaking engagements on behalf of the Unification Church. What we're going to do now is to reprise a short section of For the Record program number 248 entitled Bushed, an analysis of the political heritage of George W. Bush. This, in turn, excerpts For the Record program number 84. Again, from For the Record program number 228. After his retirement from the presidency of the United States, George Bush Sr. has occupied himself, among other things, with making speeches for the Moon Organization, as we talked about in For the Record program number 84. This is excerpted from IF Magazine's issue of September and October of 1997, an article by Robert Perry entitled The Dark Side of Reverend Moon, again from For the Record program number 84. The controversy and the Catholic Church's objections to Moon, Argentina's elected president, Carlos Menem, decided to reject Moon's invitation. But Moon had a trump card to play in his bid for South American respectability, the endorsement of an ex-president of the United States, George Bush. Agreeing to speak at the newspaper's launch, Bush flew aboard a private plane, arriving in Buenos Aires on November 22nd. Bush stayed at Menem's official residence, the Olivos, that's capital O-L-I-V-O-S. But Bush failed to change the Argentine president's mind. Still, Moon's followers gushed that Bush had saved the day as he stepped before about 900 Moon guests at the Sheraton Hotel. Quote, Mr. Bush's presence as keynote speaker gave the event invaluable prestige, wrote the Unification News. Father, Reverend Moon, and mother, Mrs. Moon, his wife, sat with several of the true children, Moon's offspring, just a few feet from the podium. Unquote. By the way, those references, father, mother, and the true children, are the standard Unification Church's terms for Reverend Moon, or for Sun Myung Moon, his wife, and their offspring. Continuing. Bush lavished praise on Moon and his journalistic enterprises. Quote, I want to salute Reverend Moon, who is the founder of the Washington Times and also of Tiempos del Mundo, Bush declared. A lot of my friends in South America don't know about the Washington Times, but it's an independent voice. The editors of the Washington Times tell me that never once has the man with the vision interfered with the running of the paper, a paper that, in my view, brings sanity to Washington, D.C. I am convinced that Tiempos del Mundo is going to do the same thing, unquote,
in Latin America. Bush then held up the colorful new newspaper and complimented several articles, including one flattering piece about Barbara Bush. Bush's speech was so effusive that it surprised even Moon's followers. Quote, "Once again, heaven turned a disappointment into a victory," the Unification News exulted, again quoting, "Everyone was delighted to hear his compliments. We knew he would give an appropriate and nice speech, but praise in Father's presence was more than we expected. It was vindication. We could just hear a sigh of relief from heaven," unquote.
That from For the Record program number 248, in turn excerpted from For the Record program number 84. And on the other side of For the Record program number 256, Campaign 2000, we're going to be analyzing events that have been taking place in the Middle East. As for something of a clue, bear in mind that Osama bin Laden is now being fingered as the probable suspect in the bombing of the Kohl. It appears that his family helped put forth part of the venture capital that started Arbusto Energy, George W. Bush's first energy company. The San Francisco Examiner of 10/13/2000 had the following article by Zachary Coyle of the Examiner. How events overseas can decide presidency. And it reads in part, on November 4, 1979, Iranian students stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, taking 92 hostages. 6 months later, President Jimmy Carter ordered a rescue mission that failed, with 8 people killed and 3 of 8 U.S. helicopters destroyed in a sandstorm. The 15-month hostage crisis and aborted rescue mission battered Carter's standing in public opinion polls and helped elect Ronald Reagan president in 1980. 20 years later, violence in the Middle East is once again dominating the headlines, and the turmoil could once again have a major impact on the presidential race. And we're going to be talking about that in Side 2 of For the Record program number 256. That concludes Side A of For the Record 256, being recorded on October 26th of the year 2000. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.